Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's podcast with me, Guy Foster. And in this edition, I'm going to be talking about the confusing world of ESG once again. Now, we're going to continue to have podcasts covering different ESG investment strategies in the future, of course. But for this podcast, we're actually going to look at it from a slightly different perspective. In fact, from a corporate perspective, and that, in fact, of the biggest bank in the Western world, JP Morgan. And that's because ESG is much more than just trying to design products for clients. In fact, all companies are going to have to think about ESG in terms of all of their activities, and their bank will be closely linked to that, as well as their carbon emissions. So to guide us through this is none other than the former MP for Streatham and Shadow Cabinet Minister, and now head of ESG at JP Morgan, Chuka Amuna. And he's going to put these things in the context of someone with a previous career in politics and employment law. But bear in mind, obviously, this isn't investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. And also remember that when investing, your capital's at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. And with that all said, let's talk to Chuka about the interplay of ESG and commercial banking and the rest of the economy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewin podcast. And in this edition, we're going to be talking about matters ESG, and we're going to be talking with Chuka Amuna, who is best known through his time as MP for Streatham and member of the member of the Shadow Cabinet and a few other roles as well, and who has had a very exciting career in politics, but is now taken a role as managing director and head of ESG at JP Morgan. So, Chuka, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on. Great to be joining you.
I mean, I think if we could just start off, I guess, with that transition that you've made in your career, it would be really interesting to know why you've taken this role and what it is that's led you to go from the career you've had to this one.
Well, I went into politics in the first instance. I started my principal working career as a corporate employment lawyer at the city firm Herbert Smith Freehills, which was a tremendous privilege, and I had a great experience there. But I had been bitten by the politics bug, and I'd always been interested in it, and the capacity to change things. When I first went into it in 2008, which is when I was selected as a parliamentary candidate in Streatham for Labour, it was in the midst of the whole expenses scandal when the standing of politics was at a particularly low ebb. But I always felt it was a noble calling and you can do big things in it. And so I'd been bitten by the bug, and it came to a view in my kind of mid-20s that I wanted to join Parliament and see what I could do positive in the world without sounding too grand about it. And by my surprise, ended up winning a very hard fought parliamentary selection battle to become the parliamentary candidate for Labour in Streatham in 2008. And then I was elected in 2010. And again, much to my surprise, ended up in the shadow cabinet a bit more than a year after joining Parliament as a shadow business secretary. And it was a role I absolutely loved. But it did actually change my outlook somewhat, in the sense that when I joined the House of Commons, I envisaged, retiring there. But I quickly came to realise that I wasn't going to be a lifer, actually, in the Commons. And I certainly didn't want to retire as a politician. I wanted to return to the private sector. And so much of what I'd been doing as a Shadow Secretary of State for Business, Innovation and Skills was about how do we reconfigure capitalism. I ultimately believe that for all its flaws, it is definitely the best way to organise society, but there are different varieties of capitalism, and I had become convinced that the model that had subsisted up until the global financial crash certainly was not sustainable, wasn't delivering enough for enough people, and that we needed to change it. In addition, of course, it was killing our planet. And whilst I could see that you have capacity to do a lot about that in public policy, particularly if you're in government, I also really came to see just the extent to which you can do that in the private sector in a way that I hadn't really as a corporate lawyer. And so having done my 10 years, I left the Labour Party for well-publicised reasons. And to be honest, at that point, decided that it was time for me to move on, pass the baton on. I figured that when I returned to the private sector, I wanted to go into capital markets and financial services, return to that space again. and join an institution where one could actually, you know, begin to continue to work on those things, but from a different angle. And there is no greater, more wonderful platform in a way, in that sense, to do that in financial services than at JP Morgan, which is, you know, the US's biggest bank and one of the biggest global financial services institutions in the world.
And I guess the role that you've taken is one that probably just wouldn't have existed when you, you know, back when you went into politics or when you went into law. So, I mean, does it pose a really amazing opportunity to be able to tackle such a range of issues?
Well, I think it's fair to say that wherever you sit in the ESG investment space, we're all kind of building the plane while we're flying it. It is new in that sense. And ESG issues and the integration of ESG factors into corporate decision making and investment decisions are material in a way that they were not before. In every transaction situation, ESG has a part to play to different degrees, to the extent that if you haven't dealt with and addressed ESG factors sufficiently, certainly on the corporate side, it can stand in the way of the successful completion of a transaction. And that's why, you know, most of the leading investment banks now have, you know, are in the process of growing ESG advisory teams to provide that service to clients, which is what I co-lead with globally with a colleague in New York, Rama Varyankovval, who heads our Center for Carbon Transition. We both globally lead that service that we provide to clients here at JP Morgan.
And that's important because I think probably our listeners will probably know JP Morgan more from the asset management side, but you are working across the sort of broader JP Morgan institution. Is that right?
That's right. My role is a little bit different to some other heads of ESG in the sense that I have a front office client facing sell side role, working directly with clients and you know, on big sell side transactions. Some of my counterparts at other places are mainly, you know, will often mainly be focused on the ESG performance of that bank without having a front office role. And the main part of my role is 80% of it is front office. I also have a role overseeing our in the EMEA region, overseeing our performance as a bank from an ESG perspective and overseeing our delivery against our global ESG goals, policies and procedures. But the mainstay of my role is the client facing part of it.
So what are the major challenges then that the bank has to face from an ESG perspective?
Well, I think when looking at it from the perspective of the bank, obviously climate change is the critical issue of our time. We're an enormous organization, 250 to 255,000 employees. We literally have probably tens of millions of people with a ownership stake indirectly or directly in the bank in terms of our shareholders. We have millions and millions of customers. Here in the UK, we have a workforce of in the region of 15,000 alone, and we have an enormous balance sheet. And so it stands to reason that our kind of reach and presence in pretty much every aspect of what society does is far bigger than other institutions. And we are where the rubber hits the road on making hard decisions and transitioning our economy and our business community, and we're a corporate citizen ourselves, to a different place so that we can continue to live on this planet. And so we have announced that we are going to align our financing portfolio in the process of doing that with the goals of the Paris Agreement. And I suppose we haven't made our lives easiest because we've kind of started by focusing on the parts of our financing portfolio that finance the sectors that are the heaviest carbon emitters. So we've started by working with our clients in the oil and gas, electric power, and automotive sectors. And we have set targets for reducing carbon intensity in those sectors to reduce climate change. And, you know, we're aiming to do that over the next 10 years. We have 2030 target. So, for example, in automotive, across scopes 1, 2, and 3, we're looking to reduce carbon intensity by 69%, which is no small thing. So if you're asking what is a challenge, I just say though those things are a challenge, but we recognize that both from a business and societal point of view, this is absolutely something that needs to happen.
And so how do you bring that about? Is that about refusing business? Is it about doing less business with certain sectors, or is it about bringing about change in those sectors?
I think it's certainly much more of the last thing you mentioned. We've already announced, for example, in relation to coal, that we will no longer be in the long term, certainly from 2024, be providing lending services or advisory to clients who derive a majority of their revenues from coal. And we're looking to phase that out by 2024. But really, it's about partnership working and working with clients to bring down the emissions intensity, the carbon emission intensity of what they do. And to be frank, I mean, this is often posed by environmentalists as a kind of battle. But the truth is that I can't think of any client I've come across who isn't aligned with our purpose and goals here, because it's a business imperative as much as it is a societal imperative. The question is how we get there. And I suppose one of the things that I think is lost on a lot of people is that even if everybody sort of gets to net zero in terms of what they're emitting, I think the IEA, which is very respected in this sphere, is estimating that a third of the emissions reduction envisaged by Paris will come from the development of new technologies that, you know, some of which don't even exist yet. There are no easy routes to achieving what we need to achieve to deliver on Paris, that's for sure. And sometimes people talk as if there are, and there aren't.
Are there, so you preempted my question, which was going to be about what the sort of client's attitude was to the efforts that you're making. I suppose the other question is, are there peers who are exerting less discipline, who don't have those ambitions, and who therefore might be sort of creating the cracks through which bad practices could continue?
I don't think it's really for me to pass judgment on what our peers are doing. What I do know is that when I look at what we've committed to doing and what we have achieved, achieving carbon neutrality, net neutrality in our operations last year and committing to do that every year, committing to finance or facilitate the finance of $2.5 trillion to deliver on the UN Sustainable Development Goals, and then of the methodology I've just explained that we're going to use to reduce our carbon intensity to bring our financing portfolio into line with Paris. I can't think of any other bank in the world that has made the same commitments. So I'm proud of that. But what our competitors do is really for them. But I think, look, it's in all our interest that the financial services sector and all its different components as a whole is joined in the effort to reduce climate change and hopefully keep temperature rises to 1.5 degrees C relative to pre-industrial levels, because the long and the short of it is, you know, if we don't resolve this issue, we're hopefully coming out of the most appalling and tragic pandemic we have seen perhaps ever. But, you know, on current estimates, if we don't do what we need to do about this, then the amount of death that we've seen in the last year or so under COVID is forecast to be happening every year if we don't solve these sustainability challenges. So that's just to really bring us down to earth and put into context what we're doing here. But yeah. Also, I don't want to sound too downbeat here. I think there's a huge commercial opportunity, massive commercial opportunity in all of this, which should be exploited, because unless companies in sectors which are the ESG leaders are the most profitable, we are not going to get the capital allocation required in the financial system to solve these problems.
Excellent point. Absolutely. And you're right, obviously, that climate change, I guess, is the front and center big issue here in the world of ESG, but I'm interested, I guess, because of your history as employment lawyer, as a Labour politician, I mean, how you feel that, and because of your comments really about the sort of form of capitalism that you observed earlier in your career, I'm interested in how you feel employees are treated by companies now, and what work needs to be done in that area.
I think we're in a materially different place relative to where we were when I stopped practicing as an employment law solicitor. I'm still a solicitor, but I don't practice anymore. And I stopped practicing in 2010 when I was elected. And that's not just because I think there's greater consensus around the need to maintain a level of employee rights. It's very interesting if you say, look at the right of British politics now. The right of British politics more or less accepts the status quo in terms of the balance of power between employee and employer. So I think there's much more political consensus around that. But COVID has illustrated just, you know, how much this is the case, because not just in terms of employee rights, but the extent to which companies realize you have got to, you know, human capital management isn't just like a management issue. It goes to the heart of productivity, the mental health and well-being of the people who generate wealth for your business. And I think we've definitely seen a kind of reassertion of employee clout and power during COVID in many ways. I just think, just if you just look at the way that, you know, companies have been handling this and how much the debate on flexible working, for example, has been moved on as a result of the different working patterns we've all had in this strange, awful time in many respects that we've been living through. I think that things have definitely changed on that front.
And I mean, is that something that you engage with your clients on employment and, you know, other stakeholder issues as well?
Absolutely. And you see it playing out in different transactional contexts, you know, very publicly at the moment. You know, ESG issues of human capital management have become material issues, and not just stakeholder issues, but also impacting on your business model and therefore your equity story in the medium to long term. I just don't, you know, for me, this is certainly, I welcome all of this, because I personally believe that we need a different model. We need that. There's a lot of societal challenges. Jamie Dimon, our CEO at JP Morgan, has written extensively about this in his letter to shareholders this year, and also addressed many of these issues last year. We all know that we need to reconfigure our system and make sure it delivers, and we're determined to do that at the bank.
One of the big issues in ESG relates to social media and technology companies and privacy. So, I mean, is there action that you think you need to see from big technology companies or from the regulators of big technology companies in order to protect their, I don't know, you never quite know whether to call them their customers or their raw materials, whatever the users of social media are?
I think, well, obviously, data protection, privacy, and those issues are, you know, are core ESG issues. And I think particularly in the tech space, they are actually, you know, in some senses, a bigger issue than the E, the environment. I wouldn't say from the bank's perspective, we have a particular view. So this is very much a personal opinion. And, you know, I obviously have a bit of an interest here because I've been subject to some pretty horrid stuff on social media. And even now, the overhang of my time in politics is, you know, I sometimes forget the number of people who were reported for making various threats. But a lot of that is now playing out, and then people are being sentenced and fined, and it's in the papers and at the moment. So I just think what you've seen here is, and we looked at this when I was a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee, and we had the heads of the social media companies in to give evidence to us, is the regulation and our different frameworks for ordering society in the tech space have not been able to keep up with the explosion in tech and just the extent to which our lives have become digital. And there have been good and bad aspects of that. I mean, I think one thing that's often under-commented upon is I think the social media has been an enormous driver of ESG and the ESG investing space. It has meant it's a lot easier to get information and to see what companies are doing. We all, complain about the quality of data, the lack of data, particularly in the S space. But the long and the short of it is part of the reason that the C-suite has to take stakeholder considerations into account like never before is that if a company is not doing the right thing, people see it, and it's plastered often in video form all over social media. And if you look at the other big issue, in addition to the environment, but also race equality, the tragic murder of George Floyd, I don't believe would have had the same impact were it not for the fact that the video footage of him being killed by that police officer went viral and was on the internet. And that in turn has meant that this whole issue of race equality is being taken heed of and addressed by business leadership around the world in the way that it would never have been before. I mean, I remember when business leaders came to see me when I was a Shadow Secretary of State for Business, they would do everything to keep out of politics or any political debates. You would never have had a situation where proactively business leaders were coming out and saying things about, for example, the death of a black man at the hands of a policeman in a US state. You just would never have had that 5 or 6 years ago. And I honestly do think social media is the thing that has changed things, because people, employees have said to their CEOs, how can you look at that being broadcast on Twitter, on my YouTube, and us as an organization, of which I'm an intrinsic part as an employee, have nothing to say about that?
Yeah.
So I think the technology is, there's been good and bad aspects, and I've been on the hard end of that. But there's also been good aspects too that have changed our lives for the better.
One of the areas, and it's a useful segue, one of the areas where I think that we're seeing a lot of change at the moment is board composition. And I know this is the sort of G and ESG. It's often considered like the more boring of the letters, but I suppose there's a social aspect to it as well. Investors are trying to think about how they ensure that there is diversity on boards, partly through a drive for equality, partly just to make boards function more effectively. I'd just be really interested in your view on what the best way of doing that is, whether it's through targets, whether there's some alternative mechanism.
So in the interregnum between politics and becoming an investment banker, I sat on the boards of three UK companies, one large one, Advanced, which is the third biggest software company in the UK, a medium-sized one where I sat on its advisory board, Signal AI, and a smaller company called Digital Identity Net, and I sat on the board there. So I've kind of had some experience, I suppose, myself as an ed. I think there are two aspects to this. One is that you've got to separate out the operating committee or management committee of the company and the board. I think it's more straightforward to achieve diversity on the board because, generally speaking, you're going to go broader and wider, and the majority of board members are not people who have worked in the business. And so, if you like, there's a bigger pool of people to choose from. I certainly think there are less excuses these days for having a kind of mainly male and white board. And I actually think, frankly speaking, it was just not something that is accepted by investors, and you'll be heavily down, graded and scored down by the ESG ratings agencies if you rock up with a lack of diversity on your board. I think on the operating committees, it's a bit more of a challenge because often, because of the historic lack of diversity, you haven't got people at senior levels coming through the pipeline. And I think that there are various issues there that have to be worked through, in particular with your employees of colour. Because if we're looking at race equality, for example, their own experience and the way they, you know, what they have gone through, you have to get into their shoes and understand that. And that's one of the good things about, you know, the dreadful tragedy that was George Floyd's death, is that I think it got a lot of people who'd never thought about these issues thinking about it, and the experience of their black employees and how you're seen. And I mean, even I have, you know, in spite of, you know, I'm into my fourth career, I've been privileged enough to operate at a certain level. And even I, pretty much in most of the environments I've been in, whether it's law, politics, strategy and communications, and now in banking, I have felt like a bit of an imposter. And I did a bit call with black colleagues at JP Morgan yesterday, and it was something that was generally commented on. It's just, you naturally have that, partly because there are very few people still these days who look like you in these organizations. And to be honest, as you get more senior, you know, when I first joined Herbert Smith, which is a really progressive and pretty diverse law firm relative to others, I was one of three black fee earners out of, say, 700. In politics, I was, you know, in the shadow cabinet. I was the only black member of the shadow cabinet for most of my time in it. And it's fair to say there aren't many senior black bankers either these days. So, you know, just that experience, in spite of the fact, you know, I come from a pretty, you know, middle class background, and I went to a private school, you still face obstacles, and your experience is quite different. And to be honest, I don't think you're really going to crack the nut of the pipeline of talent and making sure that your different diverse employees make it to the top, and unless you work with them to address that and take the time to do it properly.
Okay, well, Chuka, that's been really interesting. I know you're incredibly busy, and you've just from what you've been talking about, you've obviously got a huge amount on your plate. So thanks very much for taking the time to talk to our listeners about all of this wide range of topics. And thanks also to those listeners. We hope you've found this a useful podcast, and we hope you're going to join us again for a future edition.
Thank you so much. Good to join you.